Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Rob, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, highlights from the 2024 American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO, annual meeting, The Art and Science of Cancer Care, From Comfort to Cure. This is part two of highlights from the 2024 ASCO annual meeting. Again, the art and science of cancer care, from comfort to cure. And today's program is supported by Bristol Myers Squibb and Novartis Oncology. And before I move on to telling you about introducing our first speaker, I just wanted to let you all know that there are over 300 participants on the call today. You come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, frontier, and suburban communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Algeria, Canada, Ireland, Kenya, Trinidad, Tobago, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call, and we appreciate the fact that you've all taken this time to learn more about this particular meeting in ASCO and updates from ASCO. So it's now my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Joshua Sabari. Dr. Sabari is attending physician, thoracic medical oncology, assistant professor of medicine, NYU Langone Health, Perlmutter Cancer Center. And Dr. Sabari will be addressing an overview of ASCO's 2024 theme, The Art and Science of Cancer Care, From Comfort to Cure, and specific updates on the treatment of lung cancer presented at ASCO. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Sabari.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. Thank you for having me, and thank you to Cancer Care and to all my colleagues on the call, but more importantly to the patients and their family members and advocates who are on this call. So really exciting ASCO 2024. I'll also sprinkle in some updates from our World Conference Lung Cancer as well as ESMO, our European Society of Medical Oncology, that just happened about a week ago now. But really focusing on ASCO 2024 first, the theme, the art and science of cancer care, from comfort to cure, and really a focus on managing patient symptoms, making sure that therapies are well tolerated, but also durable, and the idea of cure being an important aspect here. And we'll start with that, our first presentation. You know, we commonly talk about non-small cell lung cancer, but I want to start with small cell lung cancer here. So lung cancer on a whole is the third most common type of cancer in the United States. Globally, it's probably the second most common cancer. And we have two subtypes. We have both non-small cell as well as small cell lung cancer. Small cell lung cancer makes up about 15% of people with lung cancer, and it's a very aggressive disease. And we saw an update for patients with limited stage small cell, so earlier stage small cell, equivalent to stage 1, 2, or 3. And these patients were enrolled in a clinical trial receiving chemotherapy and radiation together. Those patients were then randomized to receive durvalumab, a PD-L1 or an immunotherapy type medicine, after completing the chemotherapy and the radiation. And this is a really interesting concept because we know in people with extensive stage small cell or metastatic small cell, immunotherapy has been an exciting opportunity. So in this trial, the Adriatic trial, we showed a tremendous improvement in response and durability of response and survival in those patients who've received immunotherapy after finishing chemotherapy and radiation. And now this is a standard of care in patients with early stage small cell lung cancer. So it's important that we're starting to see deeper and more commonly cures in limited stage disease. So that was an exciting presentation in small cell lung cancer. Now moving to the more common non-small cell lung cancer, which makes up about 85% of patients that we see in the clinic with lung cancer, and particularly starting with driver mutations. And a lot of people ask me, when we think about lung cancer, how do we think about the treatment paradigm? So it's important that we know and understand what type of mutation an individual has with lung cancer. And a lot of the updates, a lot of the exciting data presented at ASCO and some of the other meetings this year have been based on mutations or driver mutations and matching people to targeted therapies. Now, targeted therapies are unique in that they're specific to a mutation, and they generally have better responses, better durability, but more importantly, better tolerability because they're selected for an individual patient with that mutation. And when we compare targeted therapy, I want you to also think about chemotherapy, which is not directed to an individual patient with cancer, but more thinking about targeting or treating all types of cancer or lung cancer, as well as immunotherapy, which we'll talk a little bit about and we just mentioned in limited stage disease. So the first update from ASCO was for the EGFR mutant patient population. And this is the LAURA trial, and the LAURA trial looked again at early stage patients, patients with stage 1, 2, and 3A disease. And the goal for treatment in this setting is curative in its intent. And patients in this setting received surgical resection, had adjuvant or after surgery chemotherapy, and then they received osimertinib. And osimertinib is a novel third generation EGFR inhibitor that is approved in the metastatic setting. And, you know, based on the trial for the LAURA study, we saw, again, a tremendous improvement in patients receiving osimertinib in this setting. And now this, too, is an FDA-approved regimen in patients with EGFR mutation lung cancer. So exciting to see that in non-small cell lung cancer as well, particularly the EGFR mutation-positive patient population, we're seeing more durable responses as well as cures in the early stage setting. Moving now to the metastatic setting, people with extensive stage or stage 4 disease who have an EGFR mutation, we saw a couple of very exciting updates for a novel therapy called amivantamab. Now, amivantamab is an EGFR and MET bispecific antibody. So it's uniquely designed to target EGFR in a different type of way. And what we saw at ASCO 2024 was an update on the subcutaneous formulation, so not an infusion of the therapy, but an actual injection of the therapy. And the study was comparing the injection to the infusion, and what we saw was that they were very similar in the PK, or the amount of therapy that we were able to identify in people. But what was really unique and exciting was that the survival was improved with the subcutaneous formulation of amivantamab. And this is now being studied in larger patient populations. We saw about 3 weeks ago the first FDA approval of amivantamab, the same medicine we're talking about in the IV formulation, in combination with lazertinib, a third-generation EGFR TKI. So if you're keeping track, this brings now three different exciting regimens that are available to EGFR mutation-positive patients in the frontline setting. Osimertinib being a standard of care, we also have osimertinib and chemotherapy, and recently at ASCO we saw updates on amivantamab and lazertinib, a new third regimen that is approved in patients with EGFR mutation lung cancer. Now, you may be a patient or a family member on the phone hearing this information and thinking, gosh, am I on the wrong regimen? No, you're probably on the right regimen, and there's other opportunities in later line settings. If, heaven forbid, the disease progresses or changes, we can always think about using other treatments down the road. So more recently, literally 4 or 5 days ago now, we saw the FDA approval of amivantamab and chemotherapy in the second-line setting, so in people who've had growth of their cancer on Tagrisso. So again, a really exciting time in the EGFR space. And just literally 2 days ago, we saw an update on a HER3 antibody called patritumab deruxtecan, showing that it was better than chemotherapy in the later line setting. So again, even as a medical oncologist, it's complex to keep track of all the new therapies that are coming for our patients. So, you know, talk about these novel agents with your doctors in your clinical practice. And again, it's an exciting time. And, you know, just as the theme of ASCO stated, you know, we're moving from, you know, sort of comfort to cure and thinking about how we can sort of allow people to live longer and live better with this type of disease. So a lot of excitement in the EGFR space, three novel treatment options in the front line, and many coming in the later line setting. I want to move to the ALK space. So ALK is a less common alteration in lung cancer. We see it in about 3 to 5% of people with lung cancer. And there are currently three FDA-approved therapies in the ALK rearranged space that are commonly used in the frontline setting. There's alectinib, there is lorlatinib, and there is brigatinib. So one of the biggest presentations we saw at ASCO 2024 was an update on lorlatinib. It was looking at the longer-term data of patients receiving that therapy, lorlatinib. And you know, it was quite impressive that patients on lorlatinib did far better than an older generation inhibitor called crizotinib. And lorlatinib, as well as alectinib, remain a standard treatment option in the frontline setting. When we talk about side effects and sort of weighing risks and benefits, it was interesting to see that lorlatinib has a unique toxicity profile. It can have some neurocognitive changes as well as higher cholesterol and sometimes weight gain. So very interesting discussions at ASCO about how to mitigate, how to manage these side effects. And we saw that there was impressive safety with reduction of the dose. So we're able to see very good and durable responses, and we're able to mitigate some of the toxicities with lowering the dose. More recently, 2 weeks ago at the ESMO, or European Society of Medical Oncology, we saw a new agent in the ALK space, a novel therapy called NVL-655. This is from New Zealand Therapeutics. It's an interesting agent that was specifically built to target resistance mechanisms after patients have growth on alectinib or lorlatinib or brigatinib. And we know that acquired resistance, unfortunately, is inevitable in stage 4 lung cancer, and our targeted therapies are able to keep disease in check for a long time. But when we see growth or progression, we need to think about next generation inhibitors. And I was really, really excited to see an update on the ALK space from NVL-655. In patients with a specific mutation, we saw tremendous response to folks receiving the NVL-655 in this setting. So again, focusing on lung cancer, thinking about the targeted mutations, this is an exciting opportunity. So if you're dealing with lung cancer yourself, or you're a family member or an advocate for a patient with lung cancer, it's critical to ask the healthcare team taking care of you to say, what is my mutation? You know, these targeted therapies that have, you know, are in development or being developed, would I potentially benefit from those treatment options? So really exciting updates in the EGFR and the ALK mutation space. Lastly, with the last mutation that we saw, is HER2, HER2, and that's actually a pretty rare mutation. We see it in about 1 to 2%, and it's the HER2 exon 20 insertion mutation. And, you know, historically, we've really only had chemotherapy or chemotherapy and immunotherapy. We did not have a targeted treatment option available for this patient population. More recently, we saw the approval of Enhertu, which is a drug-antibody conjugate, a sort of guided warhead that, you know, directly targets with chemotherapy to the cancer cells. And Enhertu was approved in the second-line setting. There are ongoing studies now trying to move that agent into the front line. But at ASCO and World Lung, we saw exciting data on two new agents, one being BI-181, an asset from Boehringer Ingelheim called zongertinib, and we saw impressive responses to that medicine, even in patients who received prior Enhertu. And we also saw a novel agent from Bayer, BAY-292, also similarly showing us exciting activity in patients who've had growth on chemotherapy or other agents. So I think the HER2 space, which has been, you know, unfortunately sort of, you know, on the side for a long time, has now entered the mainstream, and we are now thinking about how to better target that mutation. We are seeing now the development of first-line trials, so people newly diagnosed are able to receive these agents on clinical trials. So I want to move off of the targeted therapy space. We talked about EGFR, we talked about ALK, and we talked about HER2. Very interesting and exciting data in that setting. I want to move to non-small cell lung cancer for the last part, where patients do not have a driver mutation. And we still see this in about 40 to 50% of patients who develop lung cancer. So what does that mean? That means that someone is diagnosed with a lung cancer, they get genetic testing done, testing for sort of acquired mutations. These are not inherited, they're acquired. We do the testing and we don't identify a driver mutation, telling us that these targeted therapies are not a great option or not available to patients. So then what do we think about treatment-wise? You know, standard, we think about medicines such as chemotherapy or immunotherapy. And we oftentimes combine chemotherapy and immunotherapy as well. So how do we select? How do we do that? We look at something called the PD-L1, which is a marker on the surface of the cancer cells. And if somebody has a high marker, 50% or greater of PD-L1, we oftentimes think about using a single agent PD-1 inhibitor. If the PD-L1 expression is low, less than 50%, we oftentimes will combine chemotherapy and immunotherapy as well. So one of the sort of most exciting presentations that occurred now 2.5-3 weeks ago at the World Conference Lung Cancer in San Diego was a novel therapy called ivonescimab, which is a PD-1 inhibitor bound to a VEGF inhibitor. Now, VEGF is interesting. It stands for vascular endothelial growth factor, and we've had VEGF inhibitors approved. Medicines like bevacizumab or ramucirumab, we commonly use those in lung cancer treatment up until 2016, 2017. And once we saw the approval of immunotherapy, they've really fallen by the wayside. This trial of ivonescimab, the HARMONY study, looked at this medicine, ivonescimab, a PD-1 immunotherapy, plus a VEGF inhibitor as a bispecific, versus pembrolizumab alone. And remember, pembrolizumab is a standard of care therapy. And what was really exciting to see, and I thought one of the biggest presentations at World Lung this year, was that the combination that bevacizumab or VEGF inhibitor, I should say, and PD-1, that bispecific, doubled the sort of response and the duration of response compared to pembrolizumab alone. And, you know, this was seen across all different histologies, both adenocarcinoma as well as squamous. Those are two different types of non-small cell lung cancer. And the benefit was also seen across the different PD-L1 expression. So even in the high expressors, which we know derive a lot of benefit to pembrolizumab, those patients seem to do better with ivonescimab. And when we looked at the low patients, 1 to 49, there still was that benefit. So there are now three ongoing frontline studies in the United States. We're even studying this now in the EGFR mutant population, but really I'm excited about it in patients who have a driver mutation negative disease. So again, in summary, a lot of exciting updates, both in the targeted therapy space, driver mutation positive, as well as those patients without a driver mutation. So thank you for your attention, and I'll turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Sabari. That was a superb presentation, a wonderful way to start the program today with all of the new treatments available. And I'm sure that our participants are very, very delighted to learn all this information today. And thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. Al Benson III. And Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director for Cooperative Groups, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University. And Dr. Benson will be addressing specific updates on the treatment of colorectal cancer presented at ASCO, and he'll also be addressing quality of life issues, managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Mesner, and I too thank you for joining all of us today. During the ASCO 2024 annual meeting in Chicago, there were a number of colorectal cancer abstracts presented, some of which raised controversies with approaches that remain a work in progress and will be the subject of future investigations. For example, there was a very high-profile study evaluating liver transplantation and chemotherapy compared to chemotherapy alone for individuals who were not otherwise surgical candidates and had liver metastases secondary to colorectal cancer. This was a relatively small French study, which included 47 patients in the transplant group and the same number in the chemotherapy alone group. With a median follow-up of about 5 years, it appears that the outcomes favored the patients who underwent transplantation. Of note, only 10 of the patients had no recurrence after transplant, and the remainder who did recur were able to undergo additional therapy with benefit. The majority of people developed recurrence outside the liver. Although there is no question there is growing interest in the role of liver transplantation for patients with metastatic disease confined to the liver, thus far, small numbers of individuals have undergone this type of intervention, and therefore there is more to be learned as to who might be the best individuals to undergo such a procedure. The recommendation for transplantation, therefore, requires extremely careful patient selection and extensive multidisciplinary team review, and for the individual, the understanding that risk of recurrence, including metastases outside the liver, is a significant risk, and there may or may not be opportunities to successfully treat a recurrence. Another interesting abstract representing an area of increase in importance, which also requires further research, is the use of circulating tumor DNA to determine use of chemotherapy for those with surgically resected stage 2 colon cancer who are at high risk for recurrence. Through advanced technology, it's now possible to locate circulating tumor DNA in the patient's blood, looking for potential treatment targets, but also evaluating patients to see who might be most likely to recur from their original colorectal cancer, and if treatment is effective for those who have presence of circulating tumor DNA after surgery. The majority of patients with stage 2 colon cancer do very well after their surgery and do not require any additional therapeutic approach. One of the challenges, however, has been to identify those individuals who do recur. This ASCO clinical trial, known as the Dynamic Trial, tested patients' blood for circulating tumor DNA after they had successful removal of their stage 2 cancer. Patients were randomized to either have a circulating tumor DNA guided approach versus standard management, where the decision to receive adjuvant chemotherapy after surgery was dependent on more traditional clinical and pathologic criteria. For those who underwent CT DNA guided management, if there was no evidence of circulating tumor DNA, they were observed, whereas those who were positive received standard chemotherapy. This study did show that people who had disappearance of circulating tumor DNA after chemotherapy overall did very well compared to those where the circulating DNA was persistent, which actually represented a small number of the patients. There was no clear difference between the two groups who had ctDNA testing and those who had standard management. Therefore, we cannot yet recommend use of circulating tumor DNA as a standard of care, although it still remains a subject of great interest. One of the most significant more recent advances in colorectal cancer research is the use of immunotherapy for the subset of individuals who have what's known as deficient mismatch repair or microsatellite instability high tumors. Pathologists are now routinely reporting alterations when evaluating a colorectal cancer tumor, and all colorectal cancer patients should know their mismatch repair or MSI status. Basically, microsatellites are short repeating DNA sequences across the human genome. These sequences are very prone to errors, and there are genes that can correct these errors. If the tumor has deficient mismatch repair proteins or microsatellite instability, errors are not corrected and tumors develop. About 15% of colorectal cancer patients have deficient mismatch repair tumors, and most of these are sporadic or non-inherited. However, those who do have inheritance have what is known as Lynch syndrome. In an abstract presented during ASCO this year, patients who had colorectal cancer, which had microsatellite instability, they received either combination immunotherapy with nivolumab plus ipilimumab versus chemotherapy as their initial approach for treatment. The patients who received combination immunotherapy clearly had far greater benefit, including prolonged extension of effect compared to the chemotherapy-treated patients. This study clearly supports the use of immunotherapy for these individuals and now represents a standard of care. There were also a number of other abstracts that further refine our understanding of targeted therapeutic approaches for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. It is now essential for individuals with metastatic colorectal cancer to have molecular testing of their tumors, most commonly by next-generation sequencing or NGS, that can evaluate hundreds of genes within tumor DNA, including relatively rare events such as what is known as fusions, for which there are now specific treatments. The abstracts presented at ASCO 2024 included treatment approaches for people with RAS mutations, those with BRAF mutations, and HER2 expression as examples, as to why this testing is so important, since we do have treatment approaches for individuals who have these specific molecular determinants and have shown improvement in outcomes. Finally, another critical area that is an essential component of comprehensive cancer care, as well as the subject of ongoing research, revolves around quality of life issues that not only encompass management of treatment side effects, symptoms including discomfort and pain, but also daily life issues, which include what is called the social determinants of health. Increasingly, patient-reported outcomes offering a broader picture of an individual patient's experience beyond reporting side effects alone has emerged as a critical focus of research, with integration of this type of reporting as a component of cancer treatment clinical trials. It is very important for patients to discuss their symptoms, whether chronic or ongoing or new, so that symptoms can be evaluated to determine whether the symptoms are related to the disease process or to the treatment being administered. It is very helpful for an individual to keep a diary of symptoms with a list, including questions that can be addressed during a telephone conversation or clinic visit. It is important not to minimize symptoms, even if they appear relatively minor, because symptoms may necessitate adjustments in treatment or lead to other interventions to improve specific symptoms. There are now a number of different medications that can effectively address common symptoms such as fatigue, anxiety, depression, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, or pain. Management of symptoms is important since when a person is not feeling well, it can affect their ability to interact socially, travel, eat, exercise, and sleep. It is typical for individuals with cancer to have a multidisciplinary team, which may also include psychosocial specialists, as well as the palliative care team. As oncologists, we routinely consult with our palliative care team members to assist in symptom management, which can greatly improve the patient's sense of well-being and quality of life. To conclude, it is also important to address what is known as social determinants of health, since these factors have clearly been shown to affect the outcomes for people with cancer as well as other health conditions. These factors, such as transportation needs, concerns about housing and food availability, and other social factors, if of concern to the individual, should be reviewed with the healthcare team to determine what assistance might be available to improve a person's life situation and optimize the delivery of comprehensive cancer care. So with this, I'll conclude my remarks, and thank you very much for your attention. There's certainly a lot going on in colorectal cancer research, but also in symptom management, and we hope with this type of project we'll really continue to improve outcomes for our patients. Thanks for.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Benson. That was just a superb presentation, and I think it was wonderful that you not only covered the colorectal cancer updates, but also the management, the importance of the management or treatment side effects and any discomfort, and to report those in pain to your healthcare team. And our next speaker is Dr. Eileen O'Reilly. And Dr. O'Reilly is the Winthrop Rockefeller Endowed Chair in Medical Oncology, Section Head, Hepatopancreatic, Biliary, and Neuroendocrine Cancers, Co-Director, Medical Initiatives, David M. Rubenstein Center for Pancreatic Cancer, Chair, Human Research Protection Program, NIRB, Attending Physician, Member, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. O'Reilly will be addressing specific updates on the treatment of pancreas cancer presented at ASCO and the role of supportive care. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. O'Reilly.
So thank you very much, Carolyn. Pleasure to be here this afternoon, and welcome again to the audience. So I have the topic of addressing pancreas cancer and updates from the ASCO meeting 2024. So I'll walk you through a couple of trials. We'll break it up into metastatic disease, then look at what's happening in the postoperative preventative setting, and then touch on some of the newer areas that are in development. So I'd say it was a very exciting year in many ways at ASCO. We had three major trials being presented. The first one was called the GIANT trial, and this is, I would say, a particularly important trial in pancreas cancer in that it was evaluating treatment for an older patient population and recognizing that most people with pancreas cancer are on their 60s, 70s, and 80s, and in participation in clinical trials, it typically skews quite a bit to younger people. That's important too, but it's a relatively unaddressed topic. So this particular study was focused on the older population greater than 70, or those who had an impaired level of functioning as measured by performance score, and this reflected day-to-day physical functioning, it reflected their degree of psychosocial support, their nutrition and cognition, and their overall health status. And it looked at two treatment plans, gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, which is a well-established combination, but given on an every other week schedule, and compared it to liposomal irinotecan and infusional 5-FU, dose-reduced, also given on an every other week schedule. So both of those commonly used regimens, but not compared head-to-head and not in this older, sort of more vulnerable population. Very importantly, this trial built in some careful quality of life analyses, and the learnings I think were significant. Firstly, from the chemotherapy comparison perspective, both of these regimens were relatively similar in terms of outcome. What was clear, though, is that this population can have, you know, a relatively precipitous decline, sometimes related both to the evolution of the underlying disease and the significant impacts of treatment, and that we need important tools to be able to identify whom is most likely to benefit and to tolerate one of these treatment regimens well. Having said that, there were a population of, you know, relatively healthy older people who did very well in relative terms with either of these treatments. So a lot of learnings to come, but some key sort of reference benchmarks for the future, and emphasizing what we know to be critical in the care of looking after a person with pancreas cancer is that we're focusing on their nutrition, making sure that their pain is controlled, making sure that they have enough support as much as the healthcare system can optimize that, and being judicious when there are other vulnerabilities present in terms of cognition, nutrition, physical functioning. That's one trial. The second trial is called the PASS-01 study, and this was a randomized phase two, so a late phase trial in individuals with untreated metastatic pancreas cancer. And this trial has a number of important factors too. It was designed to see, for those who get standard of care therapy, can we sort of better select which individuals should get which treatment approach. So very heavy in terms of the science, in terms of markers of chemotherapy sensitivity and resistance, and looking at the genetic profiling of these tumors and trying to inform future treatment strategies. And the overall initial chemotherapy comparison was comparing FOLFIRINOX, common, again, regimen, to gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, so oxaliplatin 5-FU, irinotecan, and leucovorin, being FOLFIRINOX and gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, and this was in a more traditional patient population that are included in clinical trials, with the average age being in the mid-60s as opposed to the mid-70s that we talked about in the other trial. So lots of outcomes to come from the correlative science. No major differences in unselected pancreas cancer from the genomic or molecular profile perspective for outcomes. But we did see that what the so-called classical type of pancreas cancer versus this basal type, this is based on gene changes in the tumor. Classical is about 80% of pancreas cancer, basal about 20%. That they have a different outcome, classical faring better, basal faring worse, and that one of the treatment choices may be better in the basal subtype. That has to be validated, but this may be a way of beginning to select chemotherapy as an option in a person with newly diagnosed untreated pancreas cancer. So more to come on that. So moving to the postoperative preventative setting, a study that's been long awaited, looking at the role of radiation after completion of chemotherapy, after a person has undergone operation for localized pancreas cancer. And this study was conceived 15 years ago and has taken a long time to mature out. But once more, important implications for practice in that for the average individual, there isn't an added value to including radiation. For subsets of people who don't have any lymph nodes involved in their resected or removed tumor specimen, there did appear to be an advantage for the inclusion of radiation, both in terms of delaying the time to the cancer coming back and in terms of length of time that people lived, acknowledging that chemotherapy has changed during the time that this study was conducted, and we don't exactly know how this information applies to the current day, except to say that for most people, radiation is a very individualized decision rather than for everyone. And then lastly, just a couple of moments on what's happening in new therapies in pancreas cancer. There's a lot happening in this space, and in the coming years, hopefully we'll have the opportunity on this call to share some of this data. RAS therapy, so RAS is a gene which is altered in the vast majority of individuals with pancreas cancer in the tumor directly. It's involved in the growth and metastatic potential of the disease, and these drugs are now in the clinic. So we have a lot of what we call preclinical trials being presented, not in people yet. We'll see more data reading out, but showing that these drugs have potential. We had some data on classes of drugs called antibody drug conjugates, which target surface markers in the cancer, and a variety of targets being evaluated, and these have potential in this disease. We saw one specifically focused on pancreas cancer, which was targeting tissue factor, which is known to confer an adverse outcome in general and sometimes associated with clotting and other factors, but this antibody drug conjugate sort of targeted molecule suggests that there may be a signal. So again, more to come. These are early sort of dose and safety finding, not prime time as yet. So overall, it was a great ASCO meeting, lots of themes to build on, emphasizing, you know, the importance of older population, integrating optimal supportive care, being judicious about treatment selection, some implications for how we approach treatment in the postoperative setting, and a view to the future with some of these new molecules. So thank you very much, and I'll pass it back to Carolyn, Dr. Messner.
Thank you so much, Dr. O'Reilly. That was just a wonderful presentation, and really wonderful updates on the treatment of pancreas cancer and also the role of supportive care. Thank you so much. I know our audience certainly appreciated this enormously. And our next speaker is Dr. Alvaro Alencar. And Dr. Alencar is Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine, Chief Medical Officer, Miami Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center, Member Lymphoma Committee at Alliance for Clinical Trials in Oncology, Hematology, Second Lead, Sylvester Global Oncology Program. And Dr. Alencar is going to address specific updates on the treatment of lymphoma presented at ASCO and the important role of clinical trials, how research increases treatment options. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Alencar.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor to be here and be able to share a little bit of the lymphoma development at ASCO. As you know, we have our hematology meeting that from our hematology society that happens in December called ASH meeting. So usually ASCO is mainly a solid tumor meeting, and what happens at ASCO is that the heme malignancies, the heme portion, really focuses on studies that have direct implication what happens with us in the clinic, while at ASH you have a lot of very basic science, a lot of more comprehensive presentations. At ASCO, what we tend to see are the studies that will have more direct impact on what we do in the clinic. And indeed, what we saw at the ASCO this year, there was nothing revolutionary in the sense that was practice changing, but really reinforcing where the field is heading, how we are changing the approach for treatment of lymphoma. And what we have seen over the last few years is this slow progressive transition from combination therapies that include a chemotherapy agent, a cytotoxic agent, or a drug that is toxic to the cells, to much more targeted therapies, so drugs that will focus on specific molecular changes, as you have seen in all the previous presentations on solid tumors, kind of the same idea, focusing on the specific genetic drivers of the disease that are responsible to the cell growth and proliferation, and really trying to kill or really turn off that specific mutation, or really using other tools, mainly our immune system, harvesting our cells and really redirecting the cells from our immune system to attack the lymphoma. So as you know, lymphoma is divided in high-grade, low-grade lymphoma, non-Hodgkin, and Hodgkin lymphoma, and we saw a little bit of everything at ASCO. So, but as we go over, there are a few themes that are kind of recurring themes that are important and that were just reinforced in the presentations that we saw this year. One is focusing on high-grade lymphomas. And we know high-grade lymphoma is the most common type is diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, actually the most common type of lymphoma between all the lymphomas. The backbone, the standard therapy has been this combination of chemotherapy, CHOP, with the immunotherapy, with the monoclonal antibody rituximab, so R-CHOP. And we know this is extremely effective. It can cure a large proportion of patients, but we still have frequent failures. So what we have seen over the years are studies trying to add additional drugs to this backbone of R-CHOP, trying to maintain this excellent efficacy, but trying to improve the response a little without increasing too much toxicity. And very recently, we had a revolution in the change of large B-cell lymphoma in first line, which was the first therapy that really demonstrated a clear benefit compared to R-CHOP, which was a drug, the addition of a drug called polatuzumab and replacing a drug called vincristine. So change it from R-CHOP to R-CHIP polatuzumab. At ASCO, we saw two other studies that were trying to do approximately the same thing, adding drugs to the backbone of the old backbone of R-CHOP. And these studies just demonstrate how challenging it is to improve on already a very good combination. So one study was from China and was adding a drug called tucidinostat, which is a histone deacetylase inhibitor. So this drug will focus on the way the genes express themselves and kind of block that expression and help modulate the way the cells grow. And when adding that drug to R-CHOP in one specific subtype of large B-cell lymphoma, as we know, large B-cell lymphoma has many different subtypes of disease, and one of this is called double expressor phenotype, which is expected to be more aggressive, more resistant to therapy than the non-double expressors. And adding tucidinostat improved the responses, gave better disease control, but increased toxicity a little bit. So suggested some benefit, but at expense of some toxicity. And the same thing happened when we add a different drug called venetoclax, now on a study in the United States called the Alliance 51701. So the same R-CHOP, the same double expressor patients, but now adding venetoclax, which is a BCL-2 inhibitor that focuses on a programmed cell death and kind of induces cell death. And by adding venetoclax to R-CHOP, trying to improve the response on the same group of double expressor patients, we saw around the same thing, a little bit of better response, but actually no improvement in long-term control of disease, no changes in survival, and more toxicity. So just showing that it's not that clear crystal that you can add, but there's always a price to pay. So it still remains the R-CHOP and mainly more and more are chip polatuzumab as the standard of care for treatment of large B-cell lymphoma. And what we take out of this, and that's the importance of clinical trials, is that maybe what we're starting to see is that we have to start moving away from this backbone of R-CHOP, trying to take more out of these chemotherapies and using more of these new targeted agents and really see if we can bring these very effective agents and be able to eliminate chemotherapy, improve efficacy, and decrease toxicity. But still today, we're not there yet in first line, but this was just one more reinforcement of what happens when we simply just add. Another important theme at ASCO was follow-ups on a critical therapy that we have available today called CAR T-cell therapy. Chimeric antigen receptor T-cells, so are, is a process where you collect the immune cells, the T-lymphocytes from the patient's body, and in a laboratory, teach them to attack the lymphoma and infuse them back on the body. So this is a revolutionary therapy that has demonstrated incredible activity, even in patients that had very hard to treat disease, very resistant disease. And what we saw at ASCO was a longer follow-up on a study called TRANSFORM. So this study was a study that evaluated lysocaptagene, is one of these CAR T products that was compared to the previous standard of care for treatment of large B-cell lymphoma that relapsed, that returned after the initial therapy. The previous standard was to give chemo, and whenever it worked, we would put patients through an autologous stem cell transplant, through a bone marrow transplant. And when you compare those two head-to-head, CAR T-cell was clearly superior. And what we see on this longer follow-up of this study, approximately 3 years of follow-up, is that this superiority remains. We see that patients are have better disease control, actually better tolerated, and really starting to see even a survival advantage compared to the previous standard. So nowadays, whenever, obviously, CAR T-cell therapy is available, patients that have disease that is completely resistant to the first line or that returns after less than 12 months from the initial treatment, those patients are preferably treated with CAR T-cell therapy versus chemotherapy followed by transplant. Chemotherapy still has a role. We use it in many circumstances, but preferably, whenever possible, we use CAR T-cell therapy in that setting, and this longer follow-up just reinforces the benefit of that. There was another very important study that followed up on the same product, on the same lysocaptagene, but now on a different lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma. And this drug is, or this product is approved for treatment of relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. And what we saw at ASCO was a focus on some specific groups of patients. Patients that are expected not to do as well because they either received many treatment lines prior to receiving CAR T-cell therapy, or they had previously been resistant or refractory to a very important class of drugs in mantle cell lymphoma called BTK inhibitors. And what we saw at ASCO is that even those higher risk patients, patients that were refractory to BTK inhibitors, patients that had received more than five previous lines of therapy, still demonstrated significant benefit, very good response, excellent tolerability to CAR T-cell, even in that very challenging setting, demonstrating how efficacious, how good CAR T-cell therapy is in the most challenging patients. We saw another study of CAR T-cell therapy now in Richter transformation. So Richter transformation is when CLL transforms into a high-grade lymphoma. Also, another type of disease that is extremely refractory, extremely resistant to therapy. And we also saw the same lysocaptagene demonstrating excellent responses that were durable and very well tolerated, just reinforcing the importance of CAR T-cell therapy in the treatment of both high and low-grade lymphoma. But CAR T-cell therapy is not the only way that we're really bringing the immune system to attack lymphoma. Another way that we do this is with a class of drugs called bispecific antibodies. So while with CAR T you train the cells to attack lymphoma, with bispecific antibodies you have a drug that has two arms. With one arm, we grab the lymphoma cell. With the other arm, we grab the immune cell to come and attack them. And we have seen an explosion of data on the use of these drugs in lymphoma. And we did have some very important follow-ups at ASCO just reinforcing the efficacy of these drugs in the treatment of lymphoma. One of these drugs is called glofitamab, is a drug that is approved for the treatment of large B-cell lymphoma. And at ASCO, we saw follow-up for the use of glofitamab in mantle cell lymphoma. And even in patients that were super resistant, just like those patients that we talked about in the CAR T-cell therapy study, so patients with mantle cell lymphoma that had received multiple lines of therapy, very refractory, even with BTK inhibitors, seeing the same excellent response rate, tolerability, and really demonstrating that you have now more than one tool that you can use to address this very difficult to treat population. Another bispecific antibody called epcoritamab that is also approved for treatment of both large B-cell lymphoma and also follicular lymphoma, we saw some interesting studies at ASCO where you're starting to use that drug in a different setting. So the drug today is approved for the treatment of the disease that returns after more than two lines of therapy. At ASCO, we saw a study evaluating the combination of epcoritamab with a combination that is currently used called R-squared or rituximab with lenalidomide. And when combining the three in first line, incredible responses, over 90% response, very good responses, excellent disease control, very well tolerated, really completely eliminating chemotherapy from the first line therapy of follicular lymphoma. So still not the standard, but just demonstrating where we're going, which is really using these drugs early on, trying to avoid chemotherapy as much as possible. Another class of agents that we use more and more are called the small molecule inhibitors. So those are pills that will focus on specific pathways of these cells. And one of these drugs are these BTK inhibitors that we talked about. So they're used for treatment of different types of B-cell lymphomas. And that venetoclax, that drug that was used to add to R-CHOP on that Alliance study, both of these drugs are oral drugs, and when combined, they are incredibly effective. And on ASCO, we had some studies that just demonstrated how active and effective this combination is, once again, even in the most challenging patients with TP53 mutation, which makes the disease highly refractory to therapy, patients with multiple lines of treatment, just demonstrating that better use, better combinations of these drugs, completely avoiding chemotherapy, still demonstrating incredible responses and excellent tolerability, even in the most hard and the harder to treat patients. And last, just a little touch on Hodgkin lymphoma. One very important study that was presented at ASCO was a study from China evaluating a new drug called Tindarpacept. That's the drug that focuses on the macrophages. Macrophages are some of the cells in our immune system that eat other cells. And sometimes these cancer cells will put a signal that says, do not eat me. So the cells are not eaten by the macrophages because of this signal. And this drug will block the do not eat me signal and will eat the cells regardless. And as you know, in Hodgkin lymphoma, we have immune therapies that are highly effective in the treatment of Hodgkin lymphoma. And we still have a few patients that will eventually have disease returning after these checkpoint inhibitors, these immune therapies. So this study was very important because it shows the possibility of using this additional drug, Tindarpacept, to a checkpoint inhibitor and demonstrating activity even in patients that were no longer responding to checkpoint inhibitors. So once again, reinforcing the beautiful path that we have ahead of us with very promising drugs, incredible combinations that are providing better and better disease control with less and less side effects.
I'd like to thank you so much, Dr. Alan Carr. That was just a wonderful presentation, very comprehensive, and also your focus on the important role of clinical trials, which is so important as well. So thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is Director, chronic myeloid leukemia program, member of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor Weill of Cornell Medicine. And Dr. Morrow will be addressing specific updates on the treatment of leukemia presented at ASCO and communicating with your healthcare team key questions to ask. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Morrow.
Thanks, Carolyn, and thanks everybody for hanging in there. I'm Michael Morrow from Memorial Sloan Kettering from the Leukemia Service here. I usually don't do this, but I'm going to indulge you and me as well and talk mostly about CML today because at ASCO in 2024, we had, I think, one of the most dramatic updates in this disease in a long time. So chronic myeloid leukemia, as you know, is a disease that's had a very treatment successful, a very successful treatment armamentarium built over the years. We started with a great example of targeted therapy with imatinib or Gleevec, an oral medication which put most patients into remission. We didn't have options like this previously. We subsequently, and that was back in 1999 and FDA approved in 2001. So fast forward 25 years. We have a total of six drugs available, and so there's imatinib, nilotinib, dasatinib, bosutinib, panitinib, and now a drug called asciminib. So asciminib was developed based on the same idea, a small molecule drug which targets a specific defect in a cancer cell. CML is a very unique blood cancer that is driven by a inadvertent genetic error, which happens not something you're born with, not something that you do anything necessary to cause, but due to simple error called the Philadelphia chromosome, which is a 922 chromosome swap and an activation of an enzyme called BCR-ABL. So there's a couple different ways you could block this abnormal protein switch that's been turned on. All the drugs we've had previously, the previous five, were all designed in a certain way, but there was another way that we could have done this, and asciminib is a novel drug called a STAMP inhibitor, or specifically targeting the myristoyl pocket. What does that mean? It's targeting another area of this abnormal switch on leukemia cells and shutting it down. So two thoughts. Would that be as good or better than some of our other options? And interestingly and convenient, could we combine treatments? We're going to focus on that first thought. And in ASCO 2024, we saw a trial where people who were newly diagnosed with CML were offered a trial, which had a very good design, where they went to the doctor and had a treatment choice offered of, okay, you have been diagnosed with CML, and which of the four medicines we normally would prescribe, all of which have very good success rates, and fortunately most have predictable or lower toxicity or side effects, and make your choice. And then in this trial, a coin toss happened, and they either got whatever the doctor and patient had decided, or this new drug, asciminib. Where was asciminib at that point? It had already been studied for over a decade, and I was part of this research, for people that had had multiple treatments previous, and it was quite effective, and it was very safe. It was approved by the FDA several years ago for people that have had two or more medications. And so it was very appropriate to say, well, maybe this could be a better frontline choice. And it would be, because the decision about what other medicine was left up to the doctor and the patient, which is a great design, it was hard to know how many patients would get each of the possible standard options. So we weren't able to compare asciminib in a statistic fashion to all the other options. But at the end of the day, the likelihood of getting a rapid and very protective remission was definitely higher with asciminib compared to Gleevec, which is our benchmark drug, or imatinib is the generic name for that. So we're not ready to retire Gleevec or imatinib. It's still a great drug, but we now know that this medicine might offer a margin of improvement. It was also numerically better than the other medications we would have chosen in this population, dasatinib, nilotinib, or bosutinib. Again, those were all quite good still. That bar is pretty high. Again, it could be a margin of benefit. Probably the most important part of the study was, well, how did the side effects look? Because this is a very treatable cancer with a high remission rate and a possibility of getting people to what's called a functional cure, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. So in this trial, which is still ongoing, the safety of asciminib seemed to be as good or better than the other choices, meaning it didn't bring any new side effects to the patient. It had low rates of side effects overall. Man, it was still somewhat more, still less likely to cause side effects than any other drug. But the overall impression from this study was that asciminib, already approved for people with CML who hadn't responded to treatment or had side effects or complication, who needed a new option. Now it was showing that it was a better first-line drug and probably even a bit safer than our current options. So that's a paradigm changer. So the FDA is looking at that data. We might see asciminib approved in the front line for chronic-based CML. It's expected where it'll be approved for any treatment position, first, second, third, fourth medicine, because we know people often need to switch for side effects or to gain best remission. The holy grail or the ultimate goal would be, can we cure more people with CML? And I know we're not able to often nail down so much cure. We're talking about advances in cancer on cancer care, but in the CML world, we define cure a little bit differently. We call it functional cure, where people are able to curtail their medications under the right circumstances and be observed. And if they don't have a significant change in their PCR reading, which is the way we measure the any residual signal from the CML. Sometimes it's not detectable. Sometimes it's just very low. Again, under the right circumstances, they may be able to be off treatment and safe. If asciminib is followed longer and puts more patients into a high-quality remission, which is what we're already showing, will it also improve the chances that people can be functionally cured? I am very hopeful that that is going to be the case. So I think we need to stay tuned and sit tight on that data. That's a very active area of research in CML. There's a lot of trials in North America by a group called the CML Consortium, which I'm also part of. It's a shameless plug. But it's actually called the Cure CML Consortium, and it was led by late Dr. Gene Curry, one of our colleagues. He really spearheaded this group. But we all work together to perform trials where patients can endeavor to try to stop treatment, and we already completed a trial called the LAST study, which was quite consistent with some of the studies done by our industry partners showing that CML treatment can be stopped safely and that quality of life improved and people did well. Not all was successful, but it was feasible and safe and highly successful. And current trials we have are looking at second treatment-free remission. I wanted to mention them today because, you know, these are small areas of research and it's important to get the word out to patients and to providers. So if someone has tried to stop treatment for CML but has needed to go back on their medicine, their TKI, there's a trial run through most of the North American major leukemia centers where there's doctors treating CML where you could try this new medication, asciminib, in combination with your ongoing medicine that you've probably resumed to get back into remission safely, and that's already been established. Or as we evolve the trial, it may also, and we expect it will include the option to switch to this new drug, asciminib. So that's exciting reported data from ASCO, some exciting trials I want to let you know about, and just a whole lot of excitement in the field of CML, which makes my heart glow because that's what I've been doing for the last 20 to 25 years, and it's just a few days after what was National CML Day on 9/22/24. In the last couple of minutes, and to make sure we don't run over time, I'm going to touch on the point that was added, which is communicating with your healthcare team and key questions to ask. So, you know, my disease of CML, which I look after mostly, really highlighted the fact that information is power. And, you know, in some parts of the world, sometimes folks aren't getting their results or necessarily hearing about the results. And, you know, it's so important because obviously it's reinforcement, it's information. You know, sometimes it's not always good news, but news is important because then we can pivot and we can make good on that news and maybe either make a treatment change or at least know about it and manage. In CML, we're lucky. We get a lot of good news. So one of the most important advice I give people is to make sure you know, for example, what is your PCR? We literally had to generate a campaign making buttons for patients to wear in some parts of the world so their doctor, not to intimidate them, but just to remind them that, hey, make sure the patient knows exactly what their numbers are. I make sure my patients are well-informed and can read their results right off the system. They know what they're looking at. They know what that we were expecting. They know how to interpret it. We work through it together. The key questions to ask are is to probably first and foremost is to break down and understand your results, your test results, whether it's a scan or a blood test or anything. So you know what it means. It may not necessarily need to be explained in complicated terms, but at least in simple terms. Never want to have anything missing there. And then, of course, questions about side effects about medications are absolutely important. We sometimes mention, you know, what we think is important to people. If you have more questions or you need to understand more, please ask. Always ask about alternatives. Sometimes people are given a treatment or a you know, advice about a treatment, which can be very genuine and directed. But it's always good to hear what the alternatives or the other options are, if there are any, so you can make a balanced decision. And probably the hardest question to ask is, you know, is what to expect. But, you know, most of us are able to give a little bit of a crystal ball, or at least a forecast for people about, you know, how things are going to look. Because we need to live our lives and make decisions together to try to conquer cancer, like all of my colleagues and I are trying to help bring information to the table on this call. And I'm going to stop there with those bits of advice. And thanks for your attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Morrow. That was a wonderful presentation. And this is an area that you have really spent your career in working on, this particular CML, and also in terms of communicating with your healthcare team. That's such an important area as well. So thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Gregory Daniels. Dr. Daniels is professor of medicine, UC San Diego Morris Cancer Center. And Dr. Daniels is going to present specific updates on the treatment of melanoma presented at ASCO, and he's going to also provide the concluding wrap-up for part two of the 2024 ASCO annual meeting. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Daniels.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you to Cancer Care for putting these on. They're very valuable, and as you know, they are recorded for later if you need to come back and listen to us, because this is a lot of information. So, yep, I'm tasked with melanoma, which we think about as a skin cancer, but melanoma can affect other areas, including the eye or the gut. Those are subtypes of melanoma. I'm going to mostly talk about melanoma that starts on the skin, which is the most common. And taking a step back, melanoma, unfortunately, has been one of those cancers that has continued to increase in incidence rates. And now it's become a problem that can affect, depending on your skin type, as many as 3% of the population in their lifetime. But those numbers will vary geographically and, again, based on skin type, which is to say that you may know somebody with melanoma or have some questions about melanoma, because it's getting more common. It's, like a lot of cancers, does increase with age, but just like colorectal cancer, we're seeing that age shift downward, and we're seeing increased incidence in even younger people these days. So awareness, sun-safe practices, staying active, healthy lifestyle, these are all important. However, if one gets a melanoma, the best therapy is early recognition and detection and removal of that melanoma. So C-spot, C-spot change, see somebody about that spot, or if there's something that seems to stick out on your skin that's different than all the other areas, it's best to get that evaluated. So I'm going to jump into ASCO, which is predominantly focused on medical oncology or systemic treatments. And we've heard a lot of different immune therapies and targeted therapies, and these are systemic treatments. Again, a lot of patients with melanoma are successfully treated with early recognition and removal of the tumor and don't need systemic treatments. But if the tumor had been caught a little bit late or was deep at the time of resection, and we're talking millimeters, or if it involves lymph node spread, then when melanoma is cut out, our standard of therapy or standard of care has been to at least discuss with patients the opportunity to do what we call adjuvant treatment, meaning patients are cured, but we know that there's a risk of it coming back. And depending on the stage, we have some different options. Well, at this year's ASCO, another option that's been explored is that of a vaccine. And so vaccines have been tried literally for decades with disappointing success over the years. But our technology has changed, and one of the consequences of COVID was the ability to sequence DNA quickly and extrapolate mutation changes that may be recognized by the immune system, and then make a vaccine. And so these vaccines were developed very quickly. Same technology is now used and applied to cancer, and melanoma is one of those areas where tumors are sequenced, and we can figure out within days what the unique sequences are that's in that particular cancer in that particular patient. And we can estimate or guess using computer algorithms, so this is where AI starts to come in and predictive models, and we can assemble a personalized vaccine against a patient's cancer. And early clinical trials suggested that we could do this and that it was successful in generating an immune response. And now we have data that was presented. The study is called Keynote because there's a whole series of Keynote studies. And the Keynote 942 study looked at patients with resected melanoma, so they're cured, but they had a high chance of the cancer coming back. And they were given a standard drug, pembrolizumab, which blocks an immune checkpoint and has been used in many, many different types of cancers. And another group of patients were randomized to get the pembrolizumab plus the vaccine. And data at this year's ASCO showed an improvement in what we call relapse-free survival for patients getting the vaccine. So less cancer was coming back in those patients that got the vaccine. Pretty exciting because it is another way to address the cancer besides the immune checkpoints and targeted therapies that we have. However, it's not yet approved because we have to get a little more data on this and make sure it really is helpful for patients. So that's what's a couple of exciting things in the adjuvant therapy. But things are changing quickly even in the what we call neoadjuvant space. So neoadjuvant is a similar patient coming in with a high-risk melanoma but is going to go for surgery. However, we suspect that even after the surgery that there's a chance the cancer is coming back. And so giving treatment before surgery has a couple goals. One is to make the surgery maybe a little bit easier. But two is utilize the patient's immune system that's intact and before surgery to try to shrink the tumor and to get any kind of small spread areas outside that we might not be able to see on the scan, but we suspect they're there. And so this was presented maybe about a year and a half ago or so, again with the drug called pembrolizumab. And moving the pembrolizumab to just before surgery, and we saw improved outcomes. This at this year's ASCO, we had a different study called the NADINA study that looked at combination immune therapy given for a relatively short period of time of two doses prior to surgery. And a unique aspect of the study was then look at the cancer as it came out of the patient, and depending on the response, then did either more therapy or just observed. And a substantial number of patients who got immune therapy just before surgery actually had a complete pathologic response, meaning when the surgeon took out the tumor site and then the pathologist looked at it very carefully, they found no cancer in there. And in those patients, following them for some time, they did not appear to need additional treatment afterwards. So really cutting down a patient's exposure and risk to immune therapy. So pretty exciting. It was a good study, a large study. It's starting to come into clinical practice, so it's something that your physician may discuss with you. And this idea of treating patients with therapies before surgery is common in other tumor types too, including colorectal cancers, lung cancers, other cancers, and we see that outcomes are being improved. So these are all what I call advanced but early stage melanoma patients. Unfortunately, we still have patients that get what we call metastatic disease or disease that's spread through the bloodstream. And unlike a lot of other cancers, we weren't burdened with this idea that we could use chemotherapy because we knew years ago that chemotherapy had very little role in melanoma. So we've always been focused on alternatives to chemotherapy. And again, you've heard this through the other presentations of immune therapies and targeted therapies. And we have a fairly deep bench of treatments that can be used in this metastatic setting that are either those two. However, they're not the answer for everybody. They have toxicities and not everybody responds. And so recently, February of this year, was approved a therapy called tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, TILs, and the drug name is lifileucel. So this was approved. What this therapy is given to patients who have not responded to all our standard therapy options. And they have a tumor that is resectable, meaning you can take it out relatively easily, and you can grow up the immune cells within the tumor. What that does is allows us to isolate out specific immune cells that we know recognize the tumor, but just haven't been killing it. And when we expand those cells in the laboratory, and then give them back to the patients, we see that a percentage of these patients that previously had been resistant to our current treatments now get regression of cancer. Again, not everybody, but it's a great addition. It is a tough treatment, and not everybody qualifies for TILs or lifileucel. And so at ASCO this year, there were attempts to try to improve this. I'll just highlight one of many studies that are trying to improve upon TILs, and that's the OBX-115. This is, again, the same idea of taking out a tumor, isolating the immune cells. But in this case, a gene is put into the T cells. The gene is for an immune stimulant called IL-15 or interleukin-15. And then the cells are given back to the patients in the same kind of standard way that we do for TILs. And adding this gene gets around one of the hurdles of doing the standard treatment with TILs, and that is the requirement for a drug called interleukin-2. IL-2 was approved in melanoma years ago. It by itself can cure a small percentage of patients, but it requires hospitalization, and it's very stressful for the patients. We get blood pressure drops and things that require a lot of active management for patients. By giving this gene into the cells, it appears that one can get rid of the need for interleukin-2 stimulation. And so it's possible that this will decrease the toxicity for patients and maybe make this available for more patients. And so early study was presented. The work was mainly done at MD Anderson, and now this study is spread out to other institutions. And it looks very promising that we're seeing responses without the addition of interleukin-2. So, as I kind of wrap up, I do want to touch back on the other presentations, that what you're seeing is really a concerted drive to better understand what makes the cancer grow and why are they becoming resistant to our therapies. I think, in the lung cancer presentation, we've been stuck for years in small cell lung cancer without much improvement, and we've relied on chemotherapies predominantly. Well, the addition of immune therapy to limited stage small cell lung cancer is a dramatic change, and it has become the new standard of care and increasing survival. So adding in something other than chemotherapy to that disease that has been very refractory. And non-small cell lung cancer, I've been in practice now more than 20 years. This is one of the tumor types that has changed the most. And it's changed the most, I think, because really the better understanding of what's making the cancer drive and our ability to keep digging down and getting medications that get to the root cause of what makes that cancer cell a cancer cell. And so you heard about EGFR and ALK and HER2 and seeing finally meaningful shifts in the care for lung cancer patients. So going away from chemotherapy to more targeted agents and immune therapy and then addressing areas of resistance. And that was the theme throughout. Colorectal cancer, again, has moved away. We still use a lot of chemotherapy. However, we're now being able to better target that by using molecular tools. Some colorectal cancer patients have defects in how they repair DNA, and so we can get to, they're very susceptible to immune therapies. We're finding more targeted therapies. Even pancreatic cancer that really has been such a difficult challenge for us, finally finding opportunities to target those changes that have made the cancer so resistant. And then lymphomas and leukemias. Again, you heard about specific targets that when we do that, we have a chance for increasing efficacy but also decreasing the toxicity because, again, remember, chemotherapy is a lot of times affect a lot of different cells and cause death in a lot of different cell types. But targeted therapy gives us a little bit more control over what cells are succumbing to the drugs. So another exciting year, another busy year, another year with a lot of work still to do, but definite progress. So I appreciate everybody's time and attention. Thank you.
That was just a superb presentation, wonderful presentation on melanoma, all the updates at ASCO, and then the wonderful conclusion that you gave for the wrap-up of part two. So I can't thank you enough. You've done this for so many years, and I really thank you so much for doing this again this year as well, and we hope you'll do it again next year as well. And I would just like to say a few words to everyone about the services that you can access from cancer care. You heard a lot of information about the treatment of cancer. So I also want you to know that there are, cancer care does provide free programs and services nationally throughout the country. We have a HOPE line. It's a phone line that you can call, 1-800-813-4673. And you can speak to one of our oncology social workers. They take turns. They queue up to take the call, so there's no wait time. And we also have a website, www.cancercare.org. And let me just give you an idea of what some of those free programs and services are. So we do provide practical and financial assistance. We also provide co-payment assistance to help with the costs of medications. We also help with some treatment costs as well. And we also offer online support groups for people living with cancer or coping with cancer. And so that's really just a wonderful service. It's free. And if you go to our website, you'll be able to see all the different online groups we have. We have them for both young adults, older adults. We have them for particular types of cancer, for caregivers, for LGBT community, for partners, family members. So it's a whole range of people, and a lot of them, and some of them are very specific to a type of cancer as well. So those groups are very popular. We also have something called coping circles, which are support groups, and there's a theme of coping and those are available to many people as well. They're on our website as well. And we also have a host of these education programs that we offer every year. We offer about, I would say, 80 of them a year. And so that, and there are many different topics that you can access. So we hope that you'll take advantage of that as well. And again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. I also remind you that please, the information that you learned today, please take that information back to Treating Healthcare Team. They know you the best. They know all about your medical records and things like that. And they'll be able to, they will be able to address your questions as well. So in addition to your having, questions that you may want to ask, please do, ask your healthcare team those questions and ask them again and again until you get the answers that you need. Also, the idea of participating in clinical trials is very important. Ask your office and then call the cancer trial list, which lists different types of clinical trials that are going on throughout the country. Those might be very useful for you to take advantage of as well. So again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.